Our second case this morning United States against Othello, counsel for defense.
Morning. May it please the court, my name is Lieutenant Scott Stover and I represent the appellant. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd like to respectfully reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Petty Officer Othello stood charged of making a false official statement concerning whether he was legally married to Michelle Othello, and also of committing larceny to the tune of $34,000 from the U.S. government through collecting housing allowances as if he were legally married to Michelle. And during the trial, the military judge admitted over defense objection two sworn statements given by the mother of Petty Officer Othello and by Michelle Othello, wherein they state that Petty Officer Othello was in fact the oldest brother of Michelle. And accordingly, so went the government's argument, Petty Officer Othello was not legally married and thus not entitled to receive the housing allowance at the married rate. The case now centers on whether those two out-of-court statements from the accused mother and from his wife, which directly contradict the accused defense, can be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And more specifically, and really the middle of the case, is whether that particular evidence can be determined not to be harmless in the face of an otherwise strong government case, which defense acknowledges is the case here. Now, this court has stated that when determining whether a particular error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, the focus is not on whether the members were right in their findings, but rather whether the error had or reasonably may have had an effect upon the members' findings. And here, what makes the particular evidence so
how troubling, do you care to take effect further?
Pardon, Your Honor?
How are you defining effect?
I think if it had or reasonably may have had an impact on the members' determinations. And I think it's not just necessarily whether it tipped the scales. I think whether it affected even the defense's case. And I think specifically here, the particular evidence directly contradicted the defense's theory of the case. And as in United States v. Hall, I think what it did was undermine any chance the defense had of having the members find reasonable doubt in this particular case.
Okay. I thought that the test was that there was no reasonable possibility it contributed to the findings of guilt, but that's what the government had to show, that the constitutionally impermissible evidence, that there was no reasonable possibility that it contributed to the finding of guilt.
Yes, Your Honor, but if the nature of the evidence and source of the evidence directly contradicts the defense's theory as for why there was reasonable doubt, I think the effect is in essence the same thing.
I'm not arguing with you about that. I'm basically trying to determine what the standard is that we're supposed to be looking at in terms of whether this evidence was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes, Your Honor. I think in Kreutzer, this court did state that whether it contributed to the findings and then fleshed out further, using the language from Binns, which was also cited in Kreutzer and in subsequent cases, and fleshing that out, this court has said specifically what we are looking for is whether it had an effect or reasonably may have had an effect on the findings.
So let's say in the hypothetical that there's two pieces of evidence, and all parties agree that the second piece of evidence in its own right is a home run in terms of demonstrating guilt. And the first piece of evidence is a home run in demonstrating guilt as well. This person is toast if they go to trial. The first piece gets thrown out. But they're labeled one and two. And as we all know, jurors are very logical. They always take things in sequel, one, two. Are we testing, but we know with certainty that if they had only two before them, they would have convicted the person. But we don't know with certainty whether they looked at one and said, oh, well, this is conclusive, let's go home. What are we getting at here, in your view?
Of course, it's impossible to really know what goes on in the deliberation room, but I think if you had those two pieces of evidence, which were of essentially the same character from essentially the same source or of a sufficiently similar source, to whether it's virtually identical, I think you could fairly say that such a case could be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
And why is that? Because surely you couldn't say that it didn't contribute to the verdict because you don't know which piece they looked at first. For all we know in the hypothetical, they never looked at two.
That's true, Your Honor. I think what would distinguish it would be the fact that you have perfectly admissible evidence of the exact same character from a similar source, to where you can comfortably say that you don't think there's a reasonable possibility that particular piece of evidence was what was swayed them or would have prevented them either swayed them from going one way or prevented them from going another. And I don't.
Would you call that impact on the verdict?
I believe that is a fair way of characterizing it.
By the way, this is not a trick question.
Your Honor.
Courts wrestle with how do you get at this, because it's more than just looking at whether the evidence is overwhelming.
And I think
and less than just looking at whether it went before the members.
Yes, Your Honor. And using the framework of the facts in this particular case, I think if you had additional evidence from, say, additional admissible evidence from, say, the father of the officer, if there were, say, another close relative that essentially said the same thing.
Wouldn't that be cumulative?
It would be cumulative, but when determining the harm or whether there was harm, and if you assume that one was admissible and one was inadmissible, and you did admit them both, but I think that could be a case where you could still comfortably say it was reasonable beyond it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And whether, I suppose, perhaps the point of your question is maybe the government had refrained from putting in evidence for it being cumulative. I don't think, that's a difficult supposition, I think, to get into. I suppose that's a possible harm, although you could have the government weighing the relative strengths of the admissibility of evidence ahead of time and making the proper choice.
Let me go back about two moves. Are we free or not to examine the CCA's determination these statements were testimonial?
I don't believe this court is, Your Honor. I believe the law of the case would determine that is settled.
And that's a prudential doctrine, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. However, I think past precedent of this court usually suggests that this court will not do so if it could be to the detriment of the appellant. And I can't think of the name of the case, perhaps Hoth.
What about the question about availability? Are we free to look at that? That's the threshold to get into confrontation in the first place. They made a decision as to confrontation. The trial judge held they were unavailable, didn't need to reach it.
Yes, Your Honor, and that is an issue that was not challenged below by appellant. I suppose it's this court chose to, if they could, although I still think the law of the case would probably control, even though it could be to our detriment.
In the abstract, you're going to say yes, but this is the mother, the statement of the mother. And in your view, can the government ever bear its burden of overcoming beyond a reasonable doubt that the statement of the mother did not contribute to the verdict when the statement of the mother is adverse to the appellant, blah, blah, blah?
Your Honor, I'm sure that you could probably come up with a case where that could happen. And perhaps an example where you had a statement from the father or perhaps the grandmother, I think it's certainly plausible that...
But is that the essence of your case, though? This is the mother?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that it's difficult to divorce that fact when going through the analysis. So I think the source of that contradiction is indeed probably the most important factor. And in that regard, we think this case is somewhat factually similar to United States v. Hall. We also had a statement from the mother of the accused which repudiated the essence of her testimony. And this court did highlight as factors as to why that could not be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, the nature of the contradiction and also the source of that particular contradiction.
But going back to the one and two scenario of equal value, what if what if you were to stipulate, it's not your argument so much, but what if you were to stipulate that the there are two mothers, or, you know, in my family, two fathers of equal value?
I think that's a fair case, Your Honor, to say that that's sufficiently cumulative, that there's you can safely say perhaps in such a scenario that you could have an erroneously admitted piece of evidence which is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that's fair, but I also note that I don't think that...
But that's not what you're arguing here.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Going back to what the standard is for looking at harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, do you think that the CCA conducted the proper analysis, or did they conduct there's sufficient evidence to find that he's guilty even absent this evidence?
I think the second part of your question is probably more correct, Your Honor. We don't really know. They just dismissed it as that the government had an over... The evidence was still overwhelmingly strong, and I think that doesn't shed sufficient light into what analysis, if any, actually went into it, or whether they even applied... or what specific standard they actually applied, or how they went about weighing both sides of that. So.
Can you go through, please, the menu of evidence on the other side of the ledger and articulate why that does not meet your standard?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, at the outset, I'll just note that I don't think there's anything of a sufficiently similar nature or sort. There was strong evidence notwithstanding. You had testimony from two different administrators from schools that Michelle had attended. You had I think the strongest piece of evidence from the government's point of view were birth records from a Michelle Othuru to a person of the same name or similar name. It was a nickname of the same date. And that is, I think, the strongest piece of evidence from the government.
Same date and same parents.
Well,
yes or no?
It's Hatim, which is a nickname that Pediasa Othuru's mother went by, Your Honor. And I see that my time is up. May I briefly conclude answering
the question? Please finish answering the question from Judge Baker.
And I certainly acknowledge that is strong evidence. I think, though, what's important to remember is that the defense's burden here is not to prove innocence, but merely to raise reasonable doubt. And with respect to the school administrators, I think the testimony of their defense investigator with respect to the betrothal concept in Nigeria could adequately explain the school administrators. Now, with respect to the birth records, through the defense investigator, they got in an explanation from the mother that she did not know, she could not explain that, and perhaps it was a coincidence. And perhaps that's far-fetched, but again, the test is whether there's a reasonable possibility, the burden that the defense is trying to make the government meet is beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that they raise enough through their account, through the defense, to perhaps suggest that. And then when you compare that to Hall, which I think you had a similar circumstance, you had a compelling case outside of the erroneously admitted evidence, and I think the situation is sufficiently similar. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
May it please the Court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Jordan Thomas, and I represent the government in this matter. As the Supreme Court noted in Delaware v. Van Arsdell, the Constitution entitles a criminal defendant to a fair trial, not a perfect one. In that case, the Court outlined a framework for analyzing Confrontation Clause errors, applying the governing standards set forth in Chapman v. California. It's important to note that the appellant does not cite Delaware v. Van Arsdell, nor does he analyze the entire record that the Supreme Court laid out. In this Court, in cases like U.S. v. Hall, we have consistently examined the entire record of trial using the Delaware v. Van Arsdell factors to determine whether an error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Make no mistake, the appellant is urging this Court to adopt a standard that would result in automatic reversal in almost every case. Essentially, what the appellant is urging to adopt is that if the contested statements made it more likely that the members would have found the appellant guilty, then you would need to reverse the conviction. This is simply not consistent with Supreme Court precedent. If that were true, that would mean that the Van Alstyne factors do not apply. Basically, all you have to do is essentially a relevance analysis. Defendants have made similar arguments before in Harrington v. California, Schnabel v. Florida, and Chapman v. California. All the defendants urged the court to basically take a shortcut and not ask the question, what impact did the contested statements have in the greater context of the trial? The appellant cites Binns and Kreutzer for the proposition that this court can do a shortcut. However, even in Binns and Kreutzer, the court analyzed the entire record and used the factors explicitly or implicitly set forth in Delaware v. Van Alstyne. The question before this honorable court is whether the appellant's conviction should be set aside where the erroneous admission of the two contested statements had little, if any, reasonable possibility of having affected the results of the trial. The answer to this question is a resounding no. The government would demonstrate...
You mean affected the verdict or affected the deliberations?
Yes, the verdict, Your Honor. In Chapman v. California, at page 22, the court states that harmless error statutes serve a very useful purpose insofar as they block setting aside convictions for small errors or defects that have little, if any, likelihood of having changed the result of trial. Now, Delaware v. Van Alstyne provides the ability for this court to analyze harmless error to determine whether the Chapman standard is met. And it's important to note that what the appellant is urging this court to do is his interpretation of the affected language that comes from Binns, which comes from Kodiakos. Kodiakos existed when this came about in the 40s. It preceded the harmless error statutes. It preceded the governing standards set forth in Chapman v. California. And it also preceded Delaware v. Van Alstyne. And it's important to note that in Delaware v. Van Alstyne, the Supreme Court doesn't even mention Kodiakos. So I think the reliance on the affected language is an overemphasis. I'd like to focus the court on the potential harm in this case.
Counsel, this court has cited Kodiakos numerous times in recent years, so is it the government's position that we should no longer do so?
No, Your Honor. I think that the court should read Kodiakos consistently with Delaware v. Van Alstyne, which would be to look at the effect on the result of trial, not on some sort of incremental scale of this contested evidence made it more likely that the appellant would have been convicted. Now, the Supreme Court in Delaware v. Van Alstyne held that the correct inquiry is whether assuming the damaging potential of the cross-examination were fully realized, a reviewing court might nonetheless say the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Whether such an error is harmless in a particular case depends upon a host of factors. And they cite the factors importance to the testimony to the prosecution's case, whether the testimony was cumulative, presence or absence of corroborating evidence, the extent of cross-examination permitted, and the overall strength of the prosecution's case. When considered in isolation, the contested statements could be considered important in the prosecution's case. But even the appellant acknowledges that the strongest part of the government's case was the hospital records. I'm not sure if he said also the birth certificate. When the entire record is considered using the other factors set forth in Delaware v. Van Alstyne, the appellant...
Well, hang on. You said that was the strongest part of the government's case.
Yes.
So it's traditional for the trial counsel to lead with the weakest part of the case in closing argument?
Your Honor, it clearly was...
That's effective trial advocacy?
I believe that's a fair statement of best practices, but it's important to note that to think about in context. First of all, the statement for the mother was two sentences and 27 words. The statement for the...
But the mother's words... The mother may speak two words, he's guilty. That's pretty significant statement.
I agree.
And trial counsel says, first and foremost, two statements.
Yes, Your Honor. Prior to that...
Why aren't those first and foremost in your analysis, then?
Why are they not first and foremost? Immediately preceding that paragraph, Your Honor, trial counsel it urged the members to review all the documentary and testimonial evidence that was admitted during trial. Immediately following the paragraph where they referenced that statement, trial counsel told them that they did not need to begin or end their inquiry with the contested statements. And then they proceed to list a litany of documentary and testimonial evidence that was introduced during the course of the trial. The testimonial references to these statements amounts to less than a page and a half in the record by the government throughout the trial.
Do you agree with the appellant's characterization of the government's strongest documentary evidence?
No.
This is your chance to finish the menu or add to it or reorder it.
Yes, Your Honor.
They cited the school administrators and the birth records. What's your menu look like and how do you prioritize it?
Well, those are clearly important evidence for the government, but there are some things that are missing. In the November 14th, 2001 statement, the appellant admits that he hadn't seen his purported wife for over 5 years. Basically, since the alleged marriage occurred, trial counsel introduced pictures and testimony from consular investigator Reedbu, which revealed a striking familial resemblance between the appellant and Michelle Afuru. In his closing argument, defense counsel did not dispute the significance of the hospital records. In fact, he said, "I'm not going to lie to you. These records make it look like Michelle Afuru was born Adia Afuru." Government Custodial Records Adesanya, at page 535, said that both the mother and father of the baby must go to the local government offices to obtain a birth certificate, increasing further the reliability of the important and contemporaneous birth certificate for Michelle Afuru. In contrast, an employee from the National Population Commission, Adigwu, and consular investigator Nigbu all testified that Michelle Salmon's birth certificate was not genuine for several reasons. Defense counsel, in his closing argument, states, acknowledges the problems and states, it looks like somebody was trying to create something but not quite get it right. It is possible. Yes, there are school records there, but it's important that they testify that she had started school there beginning at age 7 and that the school required a birth certificate to be presented prior to the child being admitted, and that the school officials indicated that the birth certificates and information collected from the parents would be then put in the school register. The school register did not reflect Michelle as a Samuel, but as an Athulu. Senior Chief Flores testified about an interview with the appellant on November 15, 2001, in which he made several admissions. He claimed that his purported wife came to live with his family at the age of 11 or 12. Of course, this is inconsistent with the authenticated birth certificate, hospital records, the primary school records, and the testimony of a primary school teacher. The appellant also claimed that even after 5 years of alleged marriage and more than 10 years of knowing his purported wife, that he did not know anything about her family or why his parents took her in. This incredible statement, apparently designed to avoid detection about his family and about the fraud, is inconsistent with common sense and the defense investigator, Mr. O'Keequay, who testified that Michelle's father was very good friends with the appellant's father and that the Samuel family had given her up to the Athuru family. I'd like to shift focus back to potential prejudice.
Can I just ask, if you were going to start the beginning of an opinion in this case, would your first sentence be the evidence that this is harmless beyond reasonable doubt because the evidence of appellant's guilt is overwhelming, even in the absence of the statements made by Michelle and Atima Thurlow?
Yes, I think that would be a good way to begin an opinion. But I'd like to talk about the prejudice itself because I think that the question is framed by the Supreme Court in Delaware Van Arsdale is informative and will help this court in addressing the issue in writing opinion. Any potential harm is mitigated by appellant's theory of the case, his proffer of expected testimony, and other favorable evidentiary rulings made by the military judge. Throughout the trial, the appellant introduced evidence and argued in his opening at page 667 and his closing at page 833 that the contested statements were essentially true. He stated unequivocally that he was Michelle's honorary brother and that the statements reflected this, but that the government misinterpreted these statements based on a lack of understanding of Nigerian culture and custom, in particular the tradition of betrothal. And he suggested that any imprecision or contrary or adverse language in these statements was the direct result of inappropriate pressure placed upon the declarants by Consul Investigator Nigbo. On appeal, he now complains that he was not given an opportunity to cross-examine Michelle Othero, and that's a basis for harm. Specifically, during the trial at page 615, he proffered that they would have testified that the appellant Michelle Othero are not biological siblings. Michelle Othero is the child of the same family, that Michelle came to live with the appellant's family at a tender age and was raised as the adopted sister of the appellant. What the appellant ignores or fails to acknowledge is that the military judge allowed the appellant to introduce the stipulated expected testimony from Michelle Othero, and he liberally allowed the appellant to introduce hearsay testimony, extensive hearsay testimony, through defense investigator Okikwe, relating to statements made by Michelle Othero, Atim Othero, and Augustine Othero, who is the appellant's father. The stipulation and hearsay testimony allowed by the military judge thoroughly addressed the issues outlined in the proffer of expected testimony and clarified any potential confusion associated with the contested statements and further supported the appellant's theory of the case. According to the Supreme Court, as it framed the issue, the question is, how would the evidentiary record be different if the appellant had been given an opportunity to cross-examine Michelle and Tim Othero? And the answer is, not very much, based upon the appellant's theory of the case, based on the proffer of expected testimony from Michelle and Tim Othero, and based on the other favorable evidentiary rulings made by the military judge. Now, second, the contested statements were only two of many pieces of testimonial and documentary evidence admitted during the trial. Ultimately, the contested statements were independently corroborated, cumulative, and were not necessary to the success of the prosecution's case. In its case in chief, the government called 13 witnesses and introduced 18 other pieces of evidence. After reviewing the entire record, the lower court correctly concluded that the evidence of the appellant's guilt was overwhelming. And similarly, the appellant concedes at page 17 that the government's case in chief was compelling and that the birth certificate and hospital records constituted strong evidence. The defense counsel, in his closing argument, page 831 and 832, acknowledged the strength of these documents and also the questionable nature of the birth certificate associated with Michelle Samuel. Therefore, due to the overwhelming and largely uncontested evidence against the appellant, coupled with the fact that the contested statements were independently corroborated, cumulative, and not necessary to the prosecution's case, we respectfully urge this court to affirm the lower court's ruling. One note on U.S. v. Hall. Appellant talks about U.S. v. Hall and says that the court should kind of make a decision similar to that. U.S. v. Hall is distinguishable. This court analyzed Delaware v. Van Arstel and found that each and every one of the factors were wanting. And in this case, as I just said, the evidence was independently corroborated, cumulative, and the government's case was particularly strong. He characterized the government's case as in Hall as being strong, but the court actually said that all that was admitted was the urinalysis results, and it was supported by expert testimony. The court said that that was legally sufficient, but that does not constitute a strong case. This case is very different than Hall, and the nature and source language from that case only goes to whether it was important. That is only one factor of the Delaware v. Van Arsdale test. A test that the appellant has ignored. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
First, Your Honor, getting back to, I guess, trying to articulate or add clarity to what the proper test should be and whether the test is whether the evidence contributed to a defendant's conviction or whether the evidence contributed to a defendant's or to the member's verdict. I think the first part of the language articulated in Brins is somewhat useful, that the focus is not on whether the members were correct in their findings. And I think if you were to imagine in the deliberation room the members discussing whether there was reasonable doubt, and you had a member perhaps discussing what this concept of betrothal, what about this betrothal, what about the Samuel family, and what about that? I think that's where the particular evidence in question here would be used to effectively shut down any chance the defense would have in establishing reasonable doubt in this particular case.
Is the proper expected testimony part of the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt inquiry?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's a fair consideration. I don't think it's a fair characterization to say that it is a suitable substitution for cross-examination. I think it gets back to why this
is. Does the proffer address the context in which the statements had been made?
Yes, Your Honor, it does.
And what does it say about that?
Well, the proffer comes from only Michelle, if you will, so not from the mother. But in the proffer expected testimony, she states that she'd been at the consular office for several hours, I believe it was 4 hours, in excess of 4 hours. She talks about the conditions, and she talks about how she was forced to write the statement in order, or it was told to her, in order to obtain the visa, she would have to write what he told her to say. And while I think that does move us closer to the spectrum of finding harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt, I don't think that would control because, one, it doesn't qualify, I think, as a suitable opportunity to cross. Two, it doesn't address the testimony of Mrs. Othuru, the mother. And I think also the order in which the evidence was presented is also important and how it played out based on the military judge's decision to admit this hearsay evidence. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation. The case is submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:35.
Of course.